First, we're joined by Jay Hakes to discuss the role that oil has played in our foreign relations. He's an energy analyst, a former head of the Energy Information Administration, and he's now director of the Carter Presidential Library and Museum in Atlanta. He's the author of a book about what freedom from foreign oil can do for our country. That book's title, A Declaration of Energy Independence. Jay Hakes, welcome. So nice to have you in Kansas City.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
How is President and Mrs. Carter doing these days? How are they?
They are scarily healthy.
Boy, they really are.
And active. Yeah, he's 88 and she's a few years younger. And just to give you kind of an example, tomorrow he's speaking to our teacher institute. The subject is the Camp David Peace Accords, and that's something he knows a lot about. And I asked him if he'd come talk to the teachers, and he said, sure.
Wow. At 88, just rolling along.
Yeah. And he travels all over the world, still builds habitat houses.
That's amazing. How did you wind up as director of the Carter Presidential Library?
Well, I had served in both the Carter and the Clinton administrations, and I was still I'm an academic. I have a PhD from Duke and done a lot in the area of history. So as I was winding down with Clinton, I got this call and said, there's a vacancy at the Carter Library. Would you be interested in applying? President Carter would like you to apply. So I applied, and I've always been a presidential history junkie, so it was a great place to land up.
Nice place to be for a junkie, that's for sure. Well, Jay, your book, A Declaration of Energy Independence, came out in 2008. One of the key stats you cite in the book is that American dependence on foreign oil stood at 60% of total world consumption. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that our net imports which takes into account what we import and what we export, we were getting 60% of it from foreign sources. And I was ringing the alarm bells that this was a problem for the nation. And at the time, I think there was a lot of fatalism that nothing could be done about it. And some people said, well, it really wasn't worth worrying about anyway. So I argued it was important and we could do something about it.
But where does that number stand today?
We've gotten it down to about 40%.
40%.
And the trend lines are clearly there to get it down to 30. Recently, some people have said we can get it down to zero. I'm a little skeptical of that. But I think when you get it down between 20 and 30%, you face a totally different situation for economics, national security. So we've made a lot of progress since the peak actually came in 2005. Mm-hmm. And since that year, as a country, we've done some good things.
Maybe it was your book that did it.
Well, I was criticized at the time for raising this. As I said in the book, I thought the ship had started to turn because nothing changes quickly when it's as big as the energy issue. But it was turning at that time already, and maybe the book helped a little bit. I have been told by people at the White House that that they read the book on and used it in some of their policy discussions. So hopefully it did some good.
I'm wondering why it's begun to turn, because there's a terrific cartoon early in your book. I just love this cartoon. It features drawings of the presidents from Richard Nixon to George W. Bush. And above each man's head is a single word, and they tend to run together like this. It's, and that's above the head of Richard Nixon, time, we end foreign oil dependence. The point being that every president over the years has talked about this ad nauseum in many cases, and I've been on the campaign trail enough over the years, I've heard it over and over again for so many years. There's been Apollo projects and whatnot to end our dependence on foreign oil. You know, so why has it begun to change? If we've been talking about it so long, nothing happening, why is the ship turning, to use your metaphor?
Well, just first a little historical background. From 1977 to 1982, which is when the nation really got into this issue because of the gas lines, we cut our oil imports in half.
And people don't recall that exactly.
Right.
I was really struck by that stat.
It's official government data. And when my book came out, that raised a lot of eyebrows. And my argument was, if we did it before, we can do it again.
How did we do it back in the late 70s when President Carter was still in office and then Ronald Reagan?
Okay. Well, it goes back to some things Nixon did, some things Ford did, some things Carter did. We opened up the Alaska oil pipeline. We put in mileage efficiency standards for automobiles. We took the price controls off of oil so people actually had to pay the market price.
Mm-hmm.
We convinced the electric utilities to stop using oil for electric generation, and that had been as high as 17%. We insulated homes around the country, and in the Northeast they still use heating oil, so that there was a big drop in demand for heating oil.
Mm-hmm.
And people actually drove less because I think there was a reaction to the gasoline lines. And today some of those same factors are in place. You know, we're really ramping up the efficiency standards for automobiles, and there's a lot. There's three or four different trend lines that if you look at them, they're all moving in a positive direction.
What's been the most important step we've taken? I know you just mentioned gasoline standards, mileage standards for the different cars. There's been a huge fight in Washington over that over the years. How important has that been?
Well, I think it's huge. If you look at the period from 1975 to 1989 when we were toughening the standards, we were doing pretty well. And then we got away from that between 1989 and 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And we got complacent. That's when the imports really started rising. But now, you know, the target is 55 miles per gallon by the year 2025. That's very, very hefty. That's as stiff or even a little stiffer than what I was recommending in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that is very good. But while that's going on, we're also developing shale oil. We're probably going to replace Saudi Arabia as the world's major oil producer in the next few years. We're using more ethanol.
Well, say that again. So we're actually at a point where we're going to supplant Saudi Arabia as the biggest oil producer on the planet.
Yeah, if you had predicted that 10 years ago or 20 years ago, no one would have believed it. And, you know, it shows the genius of American technology. It's been a partnership with a lot of advanced technological work done by the government. And then there's a guy named George Mitchell out in Texas, an oil man, not one of the big companies. And he had faith in this hydrofracturing. And it's revolutionized the country, both for oil and for gas.
But maybe some critics would say maybe not for the better, given the potential environmental
I think you have
pitfalls.
To look at energy holistically. And when you start something like fracking, there are some accidents. Those can be regulated. I think water can be recycled. And this natural gas is displacing coal. And coal mm-hmm. is our dirtiest fuel. So people are going to be breathing cleaner air. They're going to be emitting less greenhouse gases. Now, that's not a total solution because even the gas, you know, has these emissions. But it sure is a lot better than where we were before.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that doesn't suggest that global warming still isn't a big, big problem.
No. We are making progress at the best rate we have for quite a long time. But if you look at it as a long-term problem that's building up, it's going to take more aggressive action. But I think it's good to celebrate the progress that we make, even if it's not sufficient.
I was going to say, your message today is far more optimistic. You know, people just aren't used to being optimistic when it comes to the topic of how much oil this country uses.
Yeah. Well, I try to be fact-based and research-based, and when I finished writing the book, the Congress was considering the Energy Independence and Security Act, and I didn't know whether it was going to pass or not, which is kind of difficult when you're writing a book that comes up to the present.
Yeah.
And if that had not passed, I think the tone of my book would have been pretty pessimistic. But when it passed, I saw the ingredients of really making some concrete steps forward, and so the book took on more of a optimistic tone, and someone called me Pollyannish at the time, but I think most of what I said has pretty much come true.
Jay Hakes is our guest. He's the author of a book, A Declaration of Energy Independence, How Freedom from Foreign Oil Can Improve National Security, Our Economy, and the Environment. He speaks tonight at 7 at the Truman Library out in Independence. More information at trumanlibrary.org. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888, and our email address up to date at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Are you buying the optimistic tone of Jay Hake's comments here this morning? Again, our number 816-235-2888. You know, what did you make of what Al Gore had to say just a couple of years ago when he came out so critically of President Obama? It was prior to the 2012 election. He said the administration basically had failed on the global warming front.
Well, the Congress came close during President Obama's first term to passing a cap and trade bill, and which would be a way of regulating greenhouse gases. And it got through the Democratic House. The Democrats controlled the House at the time and couldn't get through the Senate. So there was a lot of disillusionment. But I think that with the actions that President Obama has taken on the mileage efficiency standards and his notice that he will use his rulemaking authority under the Clean Air Act to deal with climate change from electric utilities, mm-hmm. that the rating would probably be higher today. You know, there has been at the end of his presidency, George W. Bush was a strong proponent of doing things to deal with climate change. And John McCain ran for president in 2008 with a strong climate change program. So it seemed like there was a national consensus. And somewhere or other in the last few years, that consensus has broken down and it's become more controversial again. But I think the underlying science is very clear about that human activities are causing global warming, and that on the whole, it's going to produce results that we're not going to be happy with. Now, somebody may like having warmer weather somewhere, but yeah. We're doing what I call in the book a dangerous experiment with the planet, because mm-hmm. we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But I don't. When you got the only planet that we know of that where humans can live, I wouldn't want to tamper with it too much.
Yeah, you know, this notion that this country is using less oil now than it was percentage wise of the world's supply of it than it was a few years ago. What happened in the mid part of the last decade to begin again to turn the ship, as you put it? We're at war with Iraq. What happened that we began to think about this in different terms?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I think whether it's implicit in our minds, I think 9/11 changed the equation a little bit, because the money that we were sending over to the Middle East somehow or other got to these terrorists. You know, exactly whose hands it went through maybe is still a matter of controversy.
But it was oil money.
It was oil money. And so I think people began to look at oil a little differently. Also, in 1999 and 2000, OPEC regained control of the world oil market. And since that time, you basically had much higher prices. And prices make a difference. If the price of gasoline is higher, people will drive a little bit less. So I think a lot of it was price-driven. A lot of it was driven by 9/11. I think that climate change, even if it's hard to get a majority of the Congress to act, some of the people that voted for the Energy Independence and Security Act did so for climate change reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of things came together. I think younger people have seen the commutes of their parents and decided they don't like that commuting culture, long periods in cars. So we're starting to see some statistical evidence in urban areas that younger people don't want to get as dependent on cars as their parents were.
Yeah, but you would have thought, Jay, that given the decades of talk about the need to deal with our oil dependence, decades of inaction on that front, that there would have been, and maybe you're saying there was one, but there would have been a seminal moment when this country sort of stopped in its tracks and said, we've got to go in a different direction. And what I sort of am sensing from what you're saying here is that we've sort of drifted into it a little bit as opposed to facing this defining moment. And maybe the defining moment was September 11th, but or not.
Well, I think it's an accumulation. When I talk about mileage efficiency standards, if you look at the Senate sponsors for the 2007 bill, every one of them was either a member of Congress or a mayor in the 1970s when the gasoline lines hit.
Wow.
So somewhere, back in the reaches of our mind for people my age, we remember those gasoline lines. So that's some motivation. And then remember, then we're sending troops into harm's way. I mean, the only foreign involvement we've had militarily has been in areas where oil is produced and exported.
And there always has been this disconnect, and you talk about this in the book, this disconnect between this notion of we're in Iraq fighting this war and this other idea, which is we're doing it to protect the oil reserves that are in that country.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting point from a historical view because it's sort of awkward to talk about we're going into a country because of their oil resources. So if you look at the public statements for the first the Gulf War and then the Iraq War, it's not mentioned very much. But then when you get the classified documents where President Bush 41 authorizes the Gulf War, it's all about oil. And, you know, we wouldn't be in these countries if it wasn't for oil. After the we went into Iraq the second time, we actually ran the country under the UN mandate, and we were setting up contracts so that they could bring in American oil companies who hadn't been welcomed there before. Well, that didn't work out because once the Iraqis got control of their government, they weren't willing to give the Americans special privileges. But oil's, if it's going on in the Middle East, there's a pretty good chance that oil is involved. And I speak a lot to military groups, and you ask any general or military planner, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, and they say, well, it's about protecting our oil supply.
And our leaders won't acknowledge that we're going to war to protect oil. Why?
Well, I mean, it's embarrassing in the countries that we're going into. I mean, it sort of looks like, you know, we're after your oil. That's, you know, one of the little ironies that I might be the only person that would notice. But when we went into the Iraq War, the second war, the British went into Basra, which is a oil port that's near Iran. And back when Harry Truman was president, I believe it was 1947, the British sent in troops to Basra because there was a strike of the oil workers. So, you know, most Americans wouldn't be aware of this connection, but I bet you in when they study the history of their own country, they're probably very aware of that. So when they see the troops coming back in, they say, oh, those were the troops that were here years ago to put down the oil strike.
And so you just get a sense then over the years, Jay, that we've just struggled with this issue so much. You get a sense that maybe Americans are finally saying, okay, we recognize now we've got to go in a different direction.
Well, it's the same thing with oil dependence and climate change. People say, well, we'd like to do that, but, man, I don't know how we would do that. It seems like it's so overwhelming we couldn't deal with it. And my argument is, well, if we're not doing mileage efficiency standards, we're not doing biofuels, we're not encouraging exploration development in the United States, of course we're not going to do anything about it. So it's laying out a path that's reasonable and convincing that people can say, well, yeah, there is a way to do it. Back in the 90s, at one point, the Congress actually passed a rule saying the Department of Transportation could not even study mileage efficiency standards.
Not at all.
No,
yeah.
But now it's come back in popularity, and so we have the tools to work with. And I think people like these new fuel-efficient cars. You know, they still accelerate fast. They've got all sorts of advanced electronics. They're very comfortable. And by the way, it also might get 40 miles per gallon.
This is going off topic a little bit, but, you know, demand is lessening. You're talking about our use of the world's oil consumption going from 60% to 40%. We're on track to get into the 30s here before too long. And yet, at the pump, prices remain $3.50 a gallon or give or take 20 cents either way. Why?
It's the price of crude oil is set in the world market, so it involves things that are going on in China, OPEC production policy. It could be in the future that American production might be the straw that breaks the camel's back and brings down world oil prices, but we have no guarantees. But oil price is not the only thing, because in the past, when we were importing all this oil, if the price went up, it really messed up our economy. And now it won't mess up our economy quite so much because, one, our oil producers will be making some of the money and our workers will be making some of the money. And also, if you're driving a car that's twice as fuel efficient, you won't be feeling the crunch as much as you would have if you were driving an old-fashioned, inefficient car.
You know, people listen to this, though, Jay, say there's always a reason why the price of gas doesn't come down. There's always something out there that sort of stops it from happening.
Well, this has been studied. I know people feel that way. But, you know, at the Department of Energy, we were asked by Congress many times. We do statistical studies, and I can pretty much follow the crude oil market. And as it goes up and down with a time lag, it will go up and down. Now, when the crude oil goes down, that station owner is not going to lower it right away. But generally, statistically, you can show that the retail price pretty much tracks the crude oil price, and it's set in the world market.
Jay Hakes is our guest. He's the author of A Declaration of Energy Independence. He speaks tonight at 7 at the Truman Library in Independence. More information about that, trumanlibrary.org, or just show up. He also is now director of the Carter Presidential Library and Museum. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to Russ from Leavenworth. Russ, good morning.
Good morning. Just a comment aside on war as an energy policy. When we decided to go into Iraq in 2003, the operational title, operations need titles, Overlord, Market Garden, Desert Shield, that sort of thing, was Operation Iraqi Liberation. And they were ready to run with that until some underpaid staffer said, hey, wait a minute, that acronym wouldn't look too good, and they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. Submitted for your consideration. Have a great day.
Yeah. The acronym would have been oil, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about that, Jay?
Well, I think it was about oil, but it also, one of the problems we have, and I'm going to speak about it tonight, is that Americans don't understand some of the countries that we're so dependent on. We just even our leaders in government come and go, and in the case of Iraq, we didn't realize that we would be turning it into a Shiite country, mm-hmm. Majority, which was great news for Iran. And going back over the decision papers and things like that, there's no record that that was even considered. So part of the problem is that not only do we become dependent on that part of the world, but we don't even understand the nuances of the politics over there well enough to make sound decisions sometimes.
Tim in Independence sends us this email at uptodate@kcur.org. A few months ago, I heard an interview that said we are building facilities in Louisiana to export fossil fuels. Won't that work against our efforts to achieve energy independence and tie our fuel costs even more to the international market?
Well, I think that I believe in fair trade because the United States exports things, and if we want people to buy our exports, and we import things, and so if someone can sell it at a higher price someplace else, I would generally support that. But I think I've been quoted in the national press on this a little bit as an outlier, but I think I will be right. That the cost of transmitting or transporting liquefied natural gas is so large, much larger than the cost of transporting oil, that I don't think we're going to be exporting that much natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a lot of gas. I don't think we'll get to the point where we're exporting oil. We just don't have enough oil to do that. We probably would have enough gas to do it, but I think that both sides are overestimating how much export they'll actually be.
Let's go to Glenn from Kansas City, Missouri. Glenn, you're on this morning with Jay Hakes. Good morning.
Good morning. Absolutely wonderful topic. Glad I'm able to put some questions here.
Good.
First question is, how much, and you, let me ask questions, you can take them as you wish. How much are the auto manufacturers invested in oil trade?
Let's take that one first. Go ahead.
Well, the auto manufacturers this time around, for the first time, voluntarily agreed to the higher limits. Now, that sounds kind of strange in a way. Of course, the government owned part of the oil companies at the time. But they wanted a level playing field, of course, the United States. And California had very strong mileage standards, tougher than the national standards. So to get a common standard across the country, they agreed to these stiff rates, and they got a few concessions in return. So right now the auto companies are supporting the higher mileage standards, which has not been the case in the past. So that's another reason for optimism, and I hope that continues.
What's your
Well, that's not necessarily to my question. My question was, how much are the auto manufacturers invested in oil?
I don't think they're invested in oil.
You don't think, or you don't know?
I think I would know if they were, and I don't believe that they are.
Okay. Second question. I have a 2008 Acadia, and any Acadia drivers out there will know exactly what I'm about to say. This is a V6 vehicle, weighs approximately 3,000, close to 4,000 pounds.
Wow.
And it gets, at best, 22 miles a gallon on the highway. That's at the very best. I used to have a Park Avenue, an 81 Park Avenue, by all measures, weighing nearly as much as this vehicle here. And the engine was a V8. When I bought the vehicle from this individual, it's a nice car. I like it. I'd still like it. I would have it today if I could.
Yeah, scoot around to your question, Glenn.
And I'm sorry. I'm sorry to space off like that. It was doing about 18 to 20 miles a gallon on the highway. The only thing I did to this vehicle when I bought it was change the tire size. I went size and a half larger than what's specced out to be. I got 25 miles a gallon out of this car. Now, I guess the larger question is, if me as an individual who has no engineering background in auto engineering, how can I affect such a drastic change in mileage in a car that's 40 years old, 30 plus years old, and the manufacturers can't do that with vehicles today?
Gotcha.
Well, it depends on what you mean by today. If you're talking about the cars that are being bought in 2013, there's a lot of technology. There's continuously variable transmission. They're using more aluminum instead of steel. In some cases, they're starting to work with fibrocarbons to replace aluminum. They can do regenerative braking where they capture the energy that's in the braking system. So if you're buying a 2013 model car, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get a lot of advanced technology. So I think they're doing it. I must have to say I'm a little skeptical that larger tires would do that. I mean, there's a lab at the University of Michigan that tests these things. The Environmental Protection Agency run tests on different things that contribute to mileage in a very scientific way. But I think the cars now are starting to show some remarkable positive changes.
Oh, boy. Well, this is a much more positive 30 minutes than I thought it was going to be, Jay. It's such a pleasure to have you here, and by all means, thanks for coming in.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Say hi to President Carter for us, too, would you? He's been on the phone with us a couple times on this show.
Sure will.
All right. Again, Jay Haig speaks tonight at 7 at the Truman Library in Independence. You can just show up or get more information, trumanlibrary.org. Jay Haig's book, A Declaration of Energy Independence.